This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories that they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And it was good while it lasted, but is this the end of the ultra-cheap mortgage?
Everything's up by 0.5%, and HSBC are making a very clear statement that that's how they see the market going. Mm-hmm. Expect everyone else to react.
Rates are going up, so too house prices, say the Halifax. Brexit, pah.
We are seeing the market reflected in its optimism by the fact that continually since that vote, house prices are increasing.
Also, it's Railmageddon. High Court battles, government plans to revolutionise the network. Won't mean much to the poor people who are losing jobs or having offers withdrawn as a result of all the delays and cancellations. It's okay because prices aren't going up in the new year. Are they?
We hear from people saying no to seeing friends and family who are missing out on birthdays and having to say no to jobs that they want to take up as well.
But actually, you know what? Who cares about the 729 Brighton to London when financial Armageddon is round the corner?
Each crisis gets bigger than the one before. Each bailout gets bigger than the one before. Mm-hmm. We're now at the point where we're beyond the capacity of central banks to save their own system.
Rachel's been speaking to one doomsayer. He reckons gold is perhaps one of your safest bets to weather the storm. So not spread betting then? Everyone's been talking about it this week. But what on earth is it?
A small number of people make money using spread bets and CFDs. A lot don't. The FCA is saying about 82% of people lose out.
And your moment has arrived. All of those hours on the phone. The long emails sent to the CEO, the angry social media posts, the moans to your family, the extra glasses of wine. Yes, the 9th annual Money Mail Wooden Spoons Award is back. Which company gets your vote? And that is the question I'm going to put to Lee and to Rachel. A very good morning to you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Rachel, to you first. Who gets your vote for the shambolic business of the year?
To be diplomatic and representative, I should probably say Vodafone, just for the quantity of emails that we get from customers who have been messed around.
Why is that diplomatic?
Because what I really want to say is my own personal one.
Well, that's what I want you to say. That's what I want you to say. What's your personal one?
British Gas. Boo.
Boo. Why?
I inherited a prepayment meter. I really wanted to change it because it costs more and it's really annoying when your gas goes out and it's cold and it's the middle of the night. I asked so many times and every time they said, sorry, you've been declined because of your credit score. So I said, well, where are you getting my credit score from? It was Experian. So I checked my credit score with Experian. Not to blow my own trumpet, but it was perfect. As it ought to have been, because I've just been given a mortgage for, you know, my potential earnings for the next 30 years of my life. It was going to be quite good. So British Gas says it's because of Experian. Experian says there's nothing we can do, it's British Gas. And this went on for more than a year. Eventually I got round it. I have to admit, I did it by phoning the press office. They were very embarrassed and sorted it out the next day. I have no idea what I would have done if I did not have that access. And it just makes me think how many people are left in this predicament that one says it's one person's fault, another says it's the other, and you just go round and round in circles. And thinking about the people who are on prepayment meters, they tend to be people who are poorer, who, if you can get off them at all, you should, because they charge more, which is in itself, I think, unfair. Yeah. Not happy with British Gas.
I should have put the kettle on and put my feet up there. Lee, for you. Thank you very much, Rachel. Lee, for you.
On the shortlist, the wooden spoon shortlist, I would definitely have to go for Southern Rail. I mean, those poor people that are on that Brighton commuter line.
But for you, Lee, it's all about you. Yeah, this is your moment.
I know I don't use it. 83,000 trains cancelled in the last year. On a personal level, banks. Just banks
all
in general. Okay. For offering such terrible savings rates to people this year. When I say terrible, I mean rates of 0.01% terrible. I think they all deserve a wooden spoon. And come on, next year, let's get some new savings rates out there and get people saving again.
Lee, you've sort of stolen my thunder there, but it's okay, because actually I had a few companies here and I thought about it. It wasn't the 6 hours I spent on the phone to HMRC, It wasn't the 1,000 social media posts I had to send to Sky, nor was it Santander for the utterly shambolic way in which they dealt with my credit card fraud. You are still dealing with it. Southern Rail. There is no question they are, without a doubt. How many wooden spoons have we got? Can we just give them all?
Let's give them all. Every single wooden spoon in shops in this country can go to Southern Rail.
Wooden spoon, Southern Rail.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. And I'm joined today by personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Financial Armageddon is just round the corner, we're hearing. But we can deal with that in a bit. Firstly, this week we've been asking if the era of record low fixed rate mortgages is at an end. Why? Because HSBC withdrew its cheapest ever deal, 0.99%, and increased rates on other products. Now that leaves First Direct's 1.09% offering, I believe, as the market leader. Lee will tell us more on that. But for how long? Here's independent consumer rights expert Martin James.
Everything's up by 0.5%, and HSBC are making a very clear statement that that's how they see the market going. Mm-hmm. Expect everyone else to react. Now, again, we were talking about the jams, the people who are just about getting by. Even a 0.25% increase on some mortgages will be enough to push people over the edge. And last year, one of the mortgage trade bodies estimated that 1.2 million people, roughly, could be affected by a 0.5% increase in mortgage costs. Cheap deals is something of an illusionary term, because it's only cheap if you can afford the mortgage in the first place, and you have to have quite a bit of a deposit to get those cheap deals in the first place, sometimes up to 20 or 30%.
Well, HSBC's 0.99% deal was launched in June at a time when competition had been really hotting up, hadn't it? It was the cheapest on the market, actually the lowest ever recorded by MoneyFacts. Why no more? Well, a lot of factors are being blamed, including Donald Trump. What's Trump got to do with it? Why are HSBC doing this? Why did mortgage rates get so low in the first place, Rachel?
Where to start? I'll start at the end.
Yep.
How did they get so low in the first place? Interest rates overall are so low across the UK, actually across really the whole developing world. We've got 0.25%. We never thought that was going to be the case. And so the cost of borrowing is so low. The cost of borrowing between banks is also very low. And so they pass that on to their customers. Why is it going up? Well, the first question is, are they? Yes, we've seen a couple of rates start to go up, and immediately there's this bandwagon reaction where everyone says this portends to something much greater. It may or may not. I just spoke to our mortgage reporter about it, Sarah Davison. Oh my goodness, she knows a lot about mortgages. And she said that yes, it could be, but also mortgage providers tend to have quotas of how much money they want to dish out every quarter. And so what they'll often do is at the beginning of the quarter, they'll put rates down a little bit to get people through the door. And then when they sort of start to reach their cap, what they're hoping to fulfil within a three-month period, if that's before the 3 months has expired, sometimes they'll put rates up a little bit so that they no longer look so attractive. It will get to the next quarter period again, and they'll put rates down. So we don't know necessarily that this is a longer term trend. There are sort of other underlying issues that may make it a more longer term prospect. The one you mentioned, Trump. The rates that we pay are influenced by the underlying rates that banks pay each other to spend money. It's called swap rates. These have started to go up a little bit since Trump won. One reason for this is that he's promising to do all sorts of things that may start to increase interest rates faster than anyone was expecting. We still don't really know what he's going to do, do we? But he has talked a bit about tax cuts, and he's talked about a boost to infrastructure worth about $550 billion. All of these things are seen as inflationary. And so if we have inflation, then the cost of borrowing will go up, and then this could start to trickle through to borrowers. But it's a bit too soon, I think, to start calling it.
And well, that's not stopped loads of people talking about it, though, have they, and suggesting that they're all going to go up and everyone's going to follow suit.
Well, no, because then you can say how clever you were to have called it. And if you're wrong, then you just remain a bit quiet for a little bit and sheepish and hope that no one notices.
Lee, are you going to be sheepish or are you going to call it?
Well, it's got to reach the bottom at some point, hasn't it?
We reached the bottom?
Well, last month, Council for Mortgage Lenders actually said officially it was a historic low for first-time buyers, for remortgages for the lowest rates ever. So, you know, there has to be a bottom at some point. Now, personally, HSBC have had this 0.99% rate for a long time now. It does come with quite a big fee as well. So we're talking almost £1,500 worth of fee. So that's why it's always important to use the This Is Money affordability calculator and actually work out, you know, the true cost of a mortgage by factoring in your fees and factoring in your percentages. And the next cheapest now that's going to be First Direct, also it comes with about £1,600 fee when it's all tied in. So let's not forget, these are headline rates. You know, they look good on paper. 0.99% sounds great, doesn't it? Because it's sub 1%. It sticks in your mind. And HSBC has been a very popular place for people to go and get a mortgage. Now, is this the bottom of the market? It's really, really too early to say. All I can tell you is that the factors at the moment are indicating, I think things are going to stay roughly the same, probably for the next few months. You know, there's been a bit of a slowdown in lending anyway. There's just a shortage of homes for sale anyway. It's very hard to call the bottom of the market. And as Rachel rightly says, I mean, people like to sort of bleat and say, this is the bottom of the market, so they can turn around and say, oh yeah, look how we called it. But let's face it, it's still an incredibly cheap time.
Well, give us some context. Like, how low is this, historically speaking?
People, you know, especially our readers, you know, will comment in our section and say 20, 25 years ago, they were paying 15% rate on their mortgage. Okay, house prices, of course, back then were subsequently lower than they are now, significantly lower than they are now. But we only have to rewind 5 years and we're talking of rates of 4 or 5%. So they have come down massively. And it has been, I know I was saying about giving wooden spoon to banks. I mean, it has been to the detriment of savers. You know, savers have been completely hit. Funding for lending helicoptered all of that cash in, which has been turned into this cheap lending so people can get on the property ladder or, you know, can get these cheap deals. The context is it, I can't stress this enough, it is still such a good time to get a mortgage. I'll give an example. My friend had a HSBC mortgage accepted at the start of the summer. It was for a new build flat. The flat got pushed back a little bit. The mortgage offer expired, so he had to go back in HSBC. In the time he went back in HSBC, the rates had gone lower and they offered him a lower rate. I mean, that is how low these have gone. And HSBC has been one of the leaders. So,
well, HSBC says, one of their spokesmen, when the cost of funding comes down, we're always quick to pass on the benefit to customers, and we've been able to do that for almost 6 months with our 0.99% rate mortgage. The cost of funding has gone up over the last month or so, and we've had to reflect that in our recent pricing review. We regularly review our rates, and while they still provide good value for those looking to move onto or up the housing ladder, should the cost of funding come back down, you can be sure we will reflect that with some great deals.
I mean, 0.99% is insane. Mm. Even 1%, 2% is pretty good stuff. And if we are worrying that people won't be able to pay their mortgages if rates go up from, you know, these rock bottom lows, then we're in trouble.
Yeah. You're getting a generation of people now who have no experience of anything higher than rock bottom.
But this is what affordability tests are for now. So, you know, there's stricter rules. You know, I think they stress test you up to 7% or something along those lines. So they will make sure that you are, you know, not getting on this rate and not going to be able to cope if rates did go up that high. I mean, it would be a slow process from going from a 1% rate, you'd suspect, to a 7% rate. And also, let's face it, not many people are going to have been getting this 0.99% rate, especially a first-time buyer is definitely not going to have a 40% deposit to put down to get this rate. So they're probably more realistically paying a 3 and 3.5% rate. So all you can say is you got to always plan for the future. You know, there's been economic uncertainty, interest rates are a record low. You've always got to be forward thinking, but not too far. You know, you don't want to be like ruining your life thinking, oh my God, in 10 years' time, my rate's going to be 10%. But it doesn't harm you to have a bit of a nest egg for that sort of thing. You know, I know it's a really boring thing for people to think about, and especially a first time buyer that just might be stretching a little bit to make ends meet at the beginning, but you can have a buffer and just to make sure you don't fall into trouble in the future.
Well, all of this comes as Halifax is telling us house price inflation has risen for the first time since March. That's despite fears June's Brexit vote would usher in falling prices. Property prices risen by 6% compared with a year ago, meaning the cost of a typical home was £218,000 and £2. Good news, says CEO of online estate agent eMove, Russell Quirk.
Brexit busting, I would say. You know, let's take ourselves back to sort of April, May this year, where the then Chancellor was talking about house prices dropping, in his words, by up to 18% following a EU vote that takes us out of the EU. We are now several months on, and we are seeing, like what's just been said in terms of a downtick in overall optimism, we are seeing the market reflected in its optimism by the fact that continually since that vote, house prices are increasing. And actually, I mean, the rate of increase versus the last report is actually up. So in the report that the Halifax issued at the end of October, that's what, end of November, their annualised house price rate of growth was just over 5%. It's now gone up to 6%. So look, real good news all around for the housing market.
Well, the faster price growth is in contrast with figures from rival Nationwide. They said annual house price growth had slowed to 4.4%. Can I just point out, I really hate house price figures. They come out like a million every month. I'm just going to throw that one out there. Lee, what can we take away from these figures?
Well, what you can take away from these figures, property prices are ticking ahead, relatively steady compared to previous years where they sort of rocketed ahead. So it's been steady growth. There was a lot of experts saying that Brexit uncertainty was going to really hit the market, and it was a sort of short-term effect, but it appears it hasn't had much of an effect on house prices. Now, the main reason for that is just supply and demand. People are taking advantage of the mortgage deals that we were just talking about. You know, so people are looking to buy property. A lot of people are, you know, maybe reluctant to list at the moment. There's been a lot of economic uncertainty out there. And the property market's quite a strange one at the moment. You know, next year, we've got some big changes coming in for buy-to-let landlords that could take a large chunk of potential investors that may be looking to invest in the property out of the market, out of the equation. We're not building enough homes. Now, there were some interesting figures also yesterday by Ricks. I know you're saying there's been loads out there, but interestingly...
Who, Ricks?
Ricks, a Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, and they're saying that... well, actually, I plucked out some of the quotes from estate agents, especially in London and the South East, who are saying that there's been a real slowdown. It's actually a buyer's market at the moment because, you know, actually people are getting a little bit scared. So there's a lot of contradicting research out there, and there always is when it comes to property. Well, you know, this time next year, let's talk about it, Georgie. We can leave it for a little while if it's getting you down.
No, I was actually giggling there because do you remember, Lee, when I asked you what you wanted to be when you were a kid?
Yeah.
So every time you talk about estate agents, I just have to have a little giggle about that one.
I would have made a really good estate agent, I think, Georgie.
I think you'd have been amazing, Lee, at whatever you've done. What number book are you on writing at the moment? A little bit of a plug there. Rachel, interesting Russell Quirk talking about the fact, and we mentioned this on the show, didn't we, as did many people, that these predictions before Brexit that house prices will fall 18%, I think it was used to persuade us not to vote to leave the EU. But of course, a lot of people were saying this is great. Who on earth thought that it could fall 18% when, like Lee said, unless you sort out supply, how are you going to sort out this issue? How are house prices going to fall by such a substantial amount? Or do you think there's still a possibility they could?
I think it could. I think that the rate of increasing demand against supply is not as high as the rate of house price increase. There's not a direct correlation there. A lot of it is about sentiment as much as anything else, whether people think that it's a good time to buy and they're ready to risk it. And I think that there still is the building blocks there for things to unravel, to go a different way. Ricks, as Lee was just talking about, Ricks, they I think issued guidance a few months ago to their surveyors that they should put a kind of a caveat in their surveys saying that things may be open to change because of Brexit.
This seems sensible.
Yeah, well, they're covering their backs, but there's still this kind of level of uncertainty. And I still believe that it just takes a change of sentiment, a change of momentum for things to move very quickly. And we assume that prices are going to continue to go up because they always have gone up, but you know, certainly recently. But this is definitely not necessarily the case. We haven't yet Brexited, so that could still have an impact. We could start to see the effects, as Lee was saying, of the really much stricter lending criteria for buy-to-let. That could also feed in. And things could still change. So I don't think that just because it's been this way for some time, it will continue to. And when things change, they often change quickly. You know, we don't have to sort of start to see a gradual decline. If momentum changes in the other direction, we've seen it again and again in the UK, but it's just that we haven't seen it for a while, so perhaps it's easier to forget.
But at the moment, it's fair to say house prices going up. Also, flip of that, is renting is going up as well. Lee, you were talking there about families that are struggling and renting no longer a hugely cheaper alternative, if indeed at all, for many. And indeed, these costs are being blamed on why there are so many more people in work but in poverty, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. They released some figures this week.
Really, what seems to us to be driving this are the rising costs that people face in their housing. Now, that's true almost entirely for those who are renting their homes. So again, if we look at those with the lowest incomes in the country, if you're in the private rented sector, three quarters of those people are paying more than a third of their income on rent. For those who are in council housing, it's about a half. If you're an owner-occupier, it's only about a quarter. That's a real big driver of why people are short of money. It's not just a crisis in wages. The private rented sector has always been very expensive if you've got a pretty low household income. Over 20 years now, we've watched this grow from a low point in the mid-90s. What's been happening is you've got more and more people now who are living in the private rented sector for years, even decades. They have very little money because rents are so high.
Lee, we focus so often, don't we? That was economist Peter Kenway there from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. But we focus so often, don't we, on house prices, buying houses. Now, I guess the spotlight, rightly so, on renting.
It's such a difficult situation that many people find themselves in. And this research found that one in every eight workers is actually living in poverty. I mean, that's quite a staggering number. Mm. And it's really difficult. And again, you know, perhaps we're talking more so here in London and the South East, you know, talking about how expensive it is to rent. I mean, just getting a rental property in the first place is a minefield because people are battling for it and landlords, you know, holding the aces, basically. And with rising rents comes zero-hour contracts for some people, comes uncertainty of part-time work, perhaps, and wages just aren't going up. I know we've got the living wage now, and perhaps that will start to make an impact. But there's too many people in, you know, such a developed country that are unfortunately living in poverty, even those that are busting the gut day in, day out to make ends meet. And if they're paying more than half their wages out on private rent, I mean, it's really hard, isn't it, to get that into context. And then we've got transport costs constantly going up. You know, it really is a tough situation. And having been a renter myself in the past and having known people that rent, it really can take up a huge chunk of your cash. And where does it all end? You were talking about house prices. Where does it all end? Where do rising rents stop? People are going to just be priced out of living altogether. What can you do? And you can see how easy it is for people to fall into difficult times when you are paying such a large chunk of your wage on rent, and then you've got bills, and then you've got transport.
Cheery chat. And it will continue because, Lee, you mentioned their transport. Coming up, we'll be talking shambolic businesses, though. It is your time to vote for the company that has caused you the most headaches this year. We'll let you know who's made the shortlist later. But completely unrelated to that, completely, totally, shambolic businesses. We're going to talk Southern Rail and train travel more generally. Delays, cancellations, job offers withdrawn, the misery continues.
Naturally, we're very disappointed by the judgment. The judge said that such unprecedented strike action by the ASLEF trade union would cause massive disruption to the travelling public. The judge also acknowledged that the widespread use of driver-only operation, both on Southern and across the UK, is perfectly safe. We brought this case for the benefit of our passengers who've suffered long enough in this dispute. The judge has given us permission to appeal at the Court of Appeal, and we will be considering this with our legal team.
Well, that was Nick Brown, their Chief Operating Officer at Govia Thames Link Railway, the owners of Southern Railway, who failed in their legal attempt to stop a series of strikes by drivers. Now, members of ASLEF are walking out for 3 days next week and six in January in a dispute over who's responsible for operating the train doors. That's after the High Court rejected an argument that the action would breach EU law by restricting freedom of movement. Here's Mick Whelan, who's General Secretary of ASLEF.
We're doing this not for money, not for terms and conditions. but purely on behalf that we believe that we need a safer railway. The method of working that was introduced in the late 80s, there's now coming to disrepute within the industry, despite the evidence given today about it being safe. We feel that it cannot be relied upon, and we do need, with the level of footfall we've got today, the population that we're talking about need to feel that they're a safe and invisible railway. And of course, post-Brussels and post-Paris, people do want safety critical staff on the railway. If we were purely doing this for money, I think the passengers have a total right to decry us in every way possible, but it's never been about that.
Well, it all comes as Transport Secretary Chris Grayling this week outlined big plans for a fully privatised railway line with tracks and trains operated by the same company. But before all that, Lee, if you would, give us a potted history of what on earth has been going on with Govia, Southern, the unions, who's to blame, who are we most angry at, why are we here?
Well, first of all, I feel so sorry for any commuter that is coming in from that line into Victoria. I mean, it must be absolutely hellish at the moment.
It's not just commuters, is it? Because doesn't it also impact the Gatwick Express? It was travellers as well.
Well, we've made this point before. I think we were talking about it when the Gatwick Heathrow decision was made. The first impressions that some tourists get when they arrive in England must be like, wow, where have I turned up? If you turn up at Gatwick and the Gatwick Express, and like, you know, pretty much all of them are cancelled or not running properly, you'd be like, wow. Yeah. Is this London? Where have I rocked up here? This makes absolutely no sense. But to give a bit of a potted history, I believe it took over the franchise about 2001, something like that. So it's had a long old time to do things right on this line. And of course, they talk about the workers there that are striking, are talking about, you know, making sure it's safe for railway users to use it, which is, of course, you know, safety is absolutely
paramount.
But you have one of the safest railway networks, arguably, in the world, you know, considering the amount of people that use it. I mean, I've travelled in the last couple of years, luckily, to America and Australia. People don't really use trains and things out there. So, you know, we're a little bit different in that respect. You know, a lot of people commute in. The strain on our major cities is pretty big. You know, even the last 10 years, I've just seen the amount of people on the trains coming into London just absolutely explode. So I understand it from that point of view. In some respects, I sometimes think it is quite dangerous getting the train because there's so many people piling on, overcrowding.
But you there are other networks where they don't have the drive, the people
exactly.
in place.
And that's the argument, isn't it? And it's really hard to sympathise with people, especially if you're going onto that line, if you're a commuter, especially commuters. That's what I feel most sorry for, because they've possibly bought a house, let's say, in Brighton with a view to commute. And if all of a sudden that shut off, coming to Brighton to London by any other means necessary, it's very difficult.
People are being priced out of London from housing
exactly.
point of view.
So there's so many underlying factors to this. It's quite unbelievable, really.
We're hearing some horror stories. I mean, some terrible stories about people not being able to get home to kiss their children, to speak to them, but also job offers being revoked. We heard that in Parliament the other day.
Yeah, people losing their jobs. Because
Can't the government step in? Can't anyone step in and sort out this mess? I mean, they took it to the High Court, didn't they?
Power of the unions, though, George, isn't it? You know, it's they're clinging on there, and in some industries, you know, unions are there, and, you know, sometimes they do work for the good, and other times they can work to the absolute frustration of people. And I think this is one of these cases now where it's rumbled on for far too long. The Transport Minister could score a massive win by just somehow sorting this out. There must be some sort of reasonable way that this can get sorted. People are going to have a miserable Christmas and New Year. I mean, it's already miserable getting a train anyway over that period, because you've got, you know, network row stuff going on. You've just got pure misery over that time anyway. And, you know, I would have thought house prices have been affected around that way as well, because people are just going, well, do you know what? We can't move there.
How long do we expect this to go on for? Is there any end in sight for this? We did get some small amount of relief in the Southern's Delay Repay 15 scheme that came out.
I mean, come off it. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. Do you know, I get the Greater Anglia train line for Liverpool Street back to where I live. I mean, trying to get this conversation is, I have to print out a letter, I have to fill in a letter, I have to put it in the post, because I'm not an annual season ticket holder, I buy it weekly. And it's just a load of hoops you have to jump through. And then you get your voucher through for like £8. And it's like, my train ticket's £118 a week. And it's an £8 refund. You're thinking, was it worth all that rigmarole? Of course it was, because I've spent 20 minutes doing it, and £8 is nothing to be sniffed at. But talking about my trip to Australia a couple of weeks ago, people out there I met could not believe how much I pay on public transport. A laughing stock around
the
world.
It's the most in Europe, isn't it?
It's got to be the most in the world. I can't see where it could be more expensive, really. I mean, when you're talking from Brighton, it's probably near enough 6 grand a year. I would have thought five
just
to six
think
grand.
How far it is. It's not very far away, really, in distance.
I know, it's ridiculous. If you work it out by mile, I mean, it probably costs like 0.1p to go to Australia on a flight, and it'd probably be about £10 a mile to get a train.
I'm laughingly out of nerves because Southern Rail is my network.
It's really hard with trains because, as I say, it's a fine balance between keeping people safe and having enough network capacity to keep everything ticking over. It's an old system. You know, we've got the oldest train systems in the world. Even the tube's looking a little bit like, you know, it's so overcrowded because we're all sort of flocking into London. And it's a really hard balance to get right. And there's always inevitably going to be delays. There's going to be problems. There's going to have to be engineering works where stuff gets updated. But in my opinion, what's happening on this Southern train line is, you know, beyond a joke, and it's got to be a priority for the Transport Minister. He's the Transport Minister. He hasn't got a lot else. Okay, Heathrow, but
well,
a lot
he did.
Else.
He
did.
He made a load of plans this week, didn't he?
Yeah, but
not a big fan of those. Well, let's land on, though, the Chris Grayling's big plans, fully privatised railway lines, smart cards, all sorts of things. Rachel, your views, what's been going on?
I mean, this is lovely, all this talk. It sounds really good, but I don't know that that makes any material difference whatsoever for the people who can't get to work or get home again on Southern Rail. We need action now, and it's good to have a bit of soul-searching at these opportunities and think about sort of privatisation and is national rail working and all that kind of stuff, but just sort it out and then look at the bigger picture. In time for Christmas, I mean, the stories, they just, you think you've heard the worst, and then they get even, you know, more terrible than that, with the cancer patients who can't get into London for appointments who are giving up on it, the people who are losing jobs because they can't get in. I know someone who leaves for work at about 5:30 in the morning because it's the only way that they think that they might be able to get in. Great bigger picture stuff, but this has to be sorted now.
And of course, only last week we had fare increases of 2.3% announced, and they take effect from 2nd of January. Another kick in the teeth for British passengers. Here's Campaign for Better Transport Executive Director Leanne Etkind.
Rail fares are too high. Just last week it was announced that they're going to go up above inflation by 2.3%. overall, and passengers are being priced off the railway. We hear from people who are saying no to seeing friends and family, who are missing out on birthdays, and having to say no to jobs that they want to take up as well, just because the rail fares are too high at the moment. And in addition to just being high, it's such a complex and complicated system as well. And we'd like to see the government make it much simpler for people to know they're always getting the best deal. And also to make sure that rail travel, which is, after all, a really environmentally responsible green way to travel, is an attractive way to travel in comparison to car journeys as well. In the last few years, the cost of fuel duty has been frozen at the same time as we've seen rail fares go up and up and up, and that's just not fair.
Lee, nodding along vigorously there, final word with you on this before we move off the platform.
Well, it's such a good point now, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, if people aren't using the trains, all they're doing is using their cars and polluting, and that's something that we're massively trying to stop in this country. And I was talking to Simon Lambert last week, and he was off to Gatwick, actually, and he just didn't trust a train, so got quoted for a taxi from his North London home to Gatwick, and it was about £25.
Yeah.
Whereas a train would have been far more than that. So what are you going to pick? So something needs to be done to make it more affordable for people. And, you know, where did the rises stop? If Southern customers have to face a 2.3% rise in the new year, I mean, that should be binned. People on that line, once it's back to normal, hopefully when it gets back to normal, should be offered like 6 months free travel or something, because it's been absolutely insane. And that's my last word on Trainways.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Now, like a subject for a Michael Lewis book this week, there's been a lot of noise about something called spread betting. But what on earth is it? City AM's Deputy News Editor, Billy Bamborough.
It is placing a bet against what the market is going to do. So you might bet that the euro is going to rise against the dollar in the next 30 seconds. You can put a £10 bet on that, and if it happens, you get a payout. If it doesn't happen, then you lose your money. So it is really just betting in real time against the market.
Well, the regulators got involved, accusing the industry of poor practices. To be fair, some figures came out. 82% of those who indulged lost money. Share prices in the companies tanked. The FCA wants to see greater risk warnings and more transparency. Not many people do it, so why is it so problematic?
It is very risky for some reasons, mainly because if with conventional shares, You can invest £1,000 in GlaxoSmithKline shares. If your investment goes up 10%, you make £100. Very nice. But with Glaxo, you could make a spread bet on Glaxo that it's going to rise. And if you put £1,000 in your account and it goes up by 10%, you'll make a lot more money. Very highly geared, but potentially you could lose a lot more than that £100. In fact, you could lose all of your £1,000 that you pay into your account, and you could lose more than that. The spread betting company could come after you and say, actually, you owe us more cash. So it's very risky, and this is true of both contracts for difference and spread bets. Some people say spread bets are really a subsection of contracts for difference, that we don't need to sort of get sucked into that too much. I think the real point here is, yes, some people, a small number of people, make money using spread bets and CFDs. A lot don't. The FCA is saying about 82% of people lose out.
Well, Share Radio senior analyst Ed Bauscher there. Rachel, spread betting, CFDs, I described it earlier this week as sort of posh gambling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not that posh. It's
well,
just
gambling.
Well, it's
sort of given that veneer of being respectable market stuff, but it's just gambling, isn't it?
Well,
is it investing? What is it?
No, it's basically heads or tails, but really high stakes. You're not betting on what way the coin goes, but you're betting on something else, probably completely arbitrary, because you're not going to be an expert on it anyway. So it could be which way the FTSE is going to go, or which way the pound might go.
But
or
don't
gold
people bet on
go.
That anyway? So what's the difference between...
So this is, you're not actually buying anything. You're not buying shares in the FTSE. You're not buying gold. You're just betting on which way it's going to go. Fair enough. If you have lots of money to play with and you think this is fun and you're arrogant enough to presume that you know which way the market's going to go, then go for it. But this report that came out this week suggested that 40% of those who do it are inexperienced. And if you don't know what you're doing, it's so dangerous because, as Ed Bauscher was saying, you can lose your money and then more. And I spoke a few months ago to a reader who was in this kind of situation, and she didn't know anything about investing. If you are going to invest, of course, the thing to do is you have you take into account your risk profile, and you decide how much you feel you can afford to lose, and then you put money into different safe options, you spread it all out. This is something that people do having no portfolio whatsoever. They just seem to often go for it. I think it's advertised sometimes. They advertise on Facebook.
Yeah.
And in all over the place, maybe on you know, TV adverts as well. I've seen on the Tube. There's a discussion here about how much you kind of you protect people, how much you say, look, we've warned you here. If you do this, you know, stupid you, get on with it. You've made your bed. And then there's the other argument that says, even if they're warned, do they really know what they're doing? And is it right that these people who have, you know, perhaps not much money to play with in the first place end up losing all of it? Should we not try and protect people, even if they are being a bit silly? And so it depends which side of that you're on. And I think that my side is that there's certainly a case to be made in some cases for there to be more protection for people. I mean, even if you've warned them, even more kind of caveats, even more kind of protection, because people are still getting caught out and losing life savings.
But there's not a lot of people that are involved in it. I think it's something that is about 120,000 people, I think, are involved
in the UK.
In the UK, and 40%, 60% are professionals, 40% normal people. Is this not just, I guess, normal gambling? I mean, the difference is it's you could do it on sports, you could do it on markets, you could do it on anything you want. And actually, why is the regulator getting involved on something which really is down to people's choice? I mean, it may not be anything to do with investing and having the right portfolio and all that sort of thing. Those sensible people surely will go for more sensible options.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely can make that argument. If you're stupid enough, then throw them to the dogs. But also there's a case, if you are going to have a regulator, perhaps part of its mandate should be to step in where people do have a possibility of losing their life savings. And it doesn't matter if it's not hundreds of thousands of people who are in that kind of predicament, even if it's hundreds of people who are in the position where they might be caught out like that. The woman who I spoke to, she had one of these companies was phoning her up or Skyping her, sending her messages several times a day saying, we've got this great bet coming up, smiley face, smiley face. We think you're not going to want to miss out on this one, wink, wink. And it's very easy when you sort of you know, you've got 30 grand of savings and suddenly in one bet you've lost 10 of them, and they say, oh, there's another bet coming up. We think that we could get you back to where you started. It's so easy for that to spiral. And yes, you cannot protect these people, but I'd say if there's a possibility to do so, it's not going to hurt the people who do it knowingly.
I wonder if it's going to have a knock-on effect, though. I mean, you said there it's widely advertised on things like Facebook, gives it that respectability, that normalcy, I suppose. And if people hear stories about the FCA getting involved, 82% of people lose their money, could this spook people who are very new to the idea of investing, perhaps wanting to get involved with this low interest rate environment that we're in, and actually read stories like this and think, it is just all of it's betting, all investing?
I think we already have so much of that kind of sentiment anyway. I don't know how much it could really add to it. And again, you see people kind of think of investing as synonymous with betting, with gambling, with insecurity. No, they'd never go for the stock market for those reasons. So if we want to do something to mitigate that, if we want to really make headway, then, not regulating spread betting is the least of our worries. We have to do something else to get people to think about investing in its merits.
OK, well, you've actually been looking at This Is Money, about the perfect portfolio. Some of the best stocks, you've compiled a list there. Lee, do you have any answers to this?
Yeah, there was plenty of house builders who've had a solid 12 months, mainly off the back of house price rises. So they're offering some good dividends. Also in the list is a couple of telecoms firms. You've got BT. You've also got ITV that have made this top 10 list. I think it's from Canaccord who've compiled this list. Now, the one thing to point out about this is that I believe it doesn't have the kind of diverse sort of mixed bag that you probably have to have a sort of, you know, you if you have a portfolio of stocks, you want to kind of not put all your eggs in one basket. So to put all your eggs into a house building basket could be quite risky in the long term if there's a turn down and, you know, prices start to fall. So yeah, it's just that they've tried to come up with basically what's been the best in the last 12 months. But, you know, unless you've got a time machine and go back 12 months, I'm not really sure what use it's going to be for you now.
Not at all. And I don't think we do sadly have one of those. But we've spoken, Lee, Rachel, we've spoken about mortgage rate rises, haven't we? Spread betting. The woes at Southern Rail. But yes, honestly, who cares about the 729 Brighton to London? It could be the least of your problems. That, by the way, is the sound of financial Armageddon. I'm not sure what that tapping was, but either way, blame the producer.
Just
there.
Having a cup of tea, waiting for the apocalypse to blow over. That's what I had in my mind.
It's when there's no tea and people just tapping the spoon against, where's the tea? Anyway, that's financial Armageddon, apparently. 2008 ain't gone nothing on what could be just around the corner, says who? Well, expert Jim Riccardi. He's been speaking to Rachel.
It's definitely coming. And the reason I say that, first of all, just historically, these things happen every 7, 8, 9 years. It's not quite like clockwork, but with a much greater frequency than people expect. So the 1994 Mexican tequila crisis, so-called, when the United States had to bail out Mexico, 1997-98, it started as an Asian crisis, went around the world, ended up in Greenwich, Connecticut at my hedge fund, Long-Term Capital Management, which became the eye of the storm. 2007-2008 started with the mortgage crisis in the United States, turned into the global financial crisis. It's been 8 years since the last one. It doesn't mean that one will happen tomorrow like clockwork, but no one should be surprised if it does.
I'm sure there are a few listeners who've had their own personal tequila crisis, but that was New York Times best-selling author, lawyer and advisor to the US Department of Defense, there Jim Rickards, predicting the biggest financial crisis ever. So is there any safe haven from this money meltdown? You're in the struggle. Any excuse. Gold apparently is set to skyrocket in value, according to Jim's predictions, with prices reaching up to $10,000 an ounce. Good old gold. So, Rachel, over to you. You've been speaking to Jim. Give us a couple of minutes on what it was like, what he was saying, and why financial Armageddon is just around the corner.
It is around the corner because, one, he believes there's a certain inevitability. It tends to be that we go in cycles. Our last recession, massive one, 7 years ago, and one 7 years before that. We're coming up around about now to another 7 years. So that's on the sort of shorter term. On the longer term, apparently we have sort of cycles as well in civilizations every couple of millennia, I think. And so by that, we're up for another one as well. But this is all heightened by the fact that we haven't recovered from the last two recessions.
That's why it's going to be worse, even though it's cyclical and booms and busts and all this sort of thing.
That we, you know, are in debt still from the last one and debt still from the one before that. And now if we are going to find ourselves in a difficult set of circumstances, we have central bankers have no money to throw at it, no ammunition. What's going to happen? And he worries that it will lead to a kind of breakdown in the whole system, that people won't trust the value of money anymore. People won't trust central bankers to be able to get us out of debt. And so that's why we'll see a collapse.
Not a majorly surprising prediction there. But, I mean, I could be wrong here. I didn't think that 2007, 2008, 2009 was a particularly great period. I mean, I think that's fair enough to say. So if this is something cyclical that happens maybe sort of 7-8 years and it produces times which aren't ideal, why don't we do something to stop it doing this cyclical thing?
Oh, but we were supposed to have. I mean, at the end of boom and bust, Gordon Brown promised that to us some time ago. I think that every time that we have a bust, there's some soul searching, we say we're never going to do that again. It almost, there's a lot of arguments, it's almost human nature, that it's sort of built into the whole system, that when there's positive sentiment, when things build up, then we get people getting overly excited about things and we go too far, and then it has to correct itself and it goes back round again, and we just have to continue doing this again and again and again.
Okay, but gold?
Yeah, Jim Rickards is great. I think he's one of those characters that I'd like to hear what his views are from time to time. And he actually believes that gold is going to really soar. Now, let me just quickly put a caveat here. He has a book out, so obviously he's trying to sell his book.
Right, it's about gold.
The New Case for Gold, it's called. And what he says, he actually says that hacking, cyber warfare and terrorism are the biggest threats to digital wealth. So what he means by that is that he believes that, you know, let's look at hacking, for example. A lot of people now don't hold tangible assets. Mm. A lot of their assets are just electrons in a computer that he says can get wiped out. And he says if there is another financial crisis and confidence in money goes down the drain, people are going to turn to physical gold because they've actually physically got it stored away somewhere. And that's why he believes it'll go, I think it's around about $1,500 or $1,600 an ounce at the moment. And I mean, $10,000 an ounce sounds mad. It's never gone above $2,000, I don't think, even in the last financial crisis when lots of people sort of ploughed into gold. But watch Rachel's Big Money Question Show. It's a real hot watch this week, and it's been very popular with our readers.
On that theme, though, of what it's like, by the way, was my gripe with Santander. Mm. I had all my cards done, basically, recently with that year's nightmare. Can I just say how tough it is when you realise how to live life with just money?
There we go.
It is so difficult.
We've all got a technological, we're relying on technology these days, and that's what we're getting pushed towards.
Absolutely. Right. Enough of that, though. Well, I know, it's terrible, isn't it? It's time. All those hours on the phone, long emails sent to the CEO, angry social media posts. Your time has come to pick the company that has given you the biggest headaches this year. I teed you up nicely. It's the 9th annual Money Mail Wooden Spoon Awards. No surprise, Southern Rail has made it onto the shortlist. Who else is up there? Who gets your vote? Lee. Tell us a bit more about the Money Mail Wooden Spoon Awards. Previous winners of that? Or
oh, man, do you know
non-winners?
What? I don't even judge years by Christmas anymore. I just judge years by when the wooden spoon comes around, and I think, God, is it wooden spoon time again? I can't believe it.
Was it Talk Talk last year?
Talk Talk has definitely been a winner in the past. My favourite part about it is when Money Mail, our sister title, Daily Mail, gets the CEO to pose with the little wooden spoon trophy, and sometimes they
kudos
refuse.
Kudos to them.
But when they do it, I mean, it's good. The BT CEO's definitely done it in the past, but on the shortlist this year, and it's very difficult to get a shortlist because you could have a long list of dozens and dozens of companies, so it is hard, and there's always naturally going to be companies that could have made the list but haven't quite.
Voted for by the public, is that
it's
right?
It's voted for by the public, so we've got you can do it on our website, or you can actually send in your views to Money Mail. They've got the address on our website. But actually, on the shortlist of 10 this year, quickly is Barclays, Barclays, British Airways, BT, Extra Energy, HMRC, Legal & General, Scottish Power, Southern Rail, Thomson and Vodafone. Now, a lot of these companies have been on this list time and time again. They always promise that they're going to give better service, customer service in the future. MoneyMail goes into vast detail on why some of these companies are in the list. So obviously Southern Rail, because of all the strikes. Vodafone, as Rachel touched on at the start of the show, have been complained about loads. The Taxman, of course, because everyone hates the Taxman because after time it doesn't do what you want it to do. And even good old cuddly British Airways after ditching its in-flight meals and
but
not dealing with
M&S. It's not just in-flight meals. It's but, M&S I mean, in-flight that you have to pay for. But
feels a bit, you know. But anyway, they're all on there. So vote for who you want, and let's hope we can get the CEO to pose with that little spoon.
Final word to you, Rachel.
This is money.co.uk/spoon. To get in your vote, the more the merrier. We can get a more accurate picture of who's been the worst this year.
Personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. No wooden spoons there.